Richard Kraft had an extramarital affair for over 20 years.
He didn't want people to know that she had left him.
They had no murder weapon. They had no witnesses.
They didn't want to believe that she wasn't alive, but nonetheless, the disappearance was under very mysterious circumstances.
Welcome to the Crime Stories Control Room. This is Murder Time. The story I'm pulling from the vault today is a bit of a heartbreaker. Some innocent kids lose their mother to a murderous father, and then learn he mutilated her remains. Our story begins in picture postcard Connecticut in the winter of 1986. Detective Michael DeJoseph of the Newtown Police Department has a problem. People keep telling him a local woman is missing, but her husband says she's not.
He said that she went to Denmark because her mother was sick.
She is Hella Crafts, a 39-year-old mother of three and a career airline attendant. Hella wants a divorce from her husband, airline pilot Richard. He's a man she deeply fears. She's so scared, she leaves her friends a message that sends chills. This is reporter Lisa Peterson.
She thought Richard might be angry at her. And also, if she should disappear or if anything should happen to her, not to assume it was an accident.
It's an unusual message and an unusual missing persons case, especially in sleepy, affluent Connecticut.
Newtown, Connecticut in the 1980s was a very quiet community, very rural. It's hilly, it's wooded, it has lakes and streams. It had wonderful schools, nice atmosphere, very safe place for you to raise your family. A great place to live.
It's not a place known for major crime. And yet, Hella Crafts has vanished. Healthy snacks have a bad reputation. And let's be honest, most don't taste very good. They don't fill you up, and they certainly don't satisfy your cravings. This episode is sponsored by Monk Pack, who makes snacks that taste like our favorite sugary treats, but with 1 gram of sugar or less. Monk Pack Keto Granola Bars contain just 1 gram of sugar, 2 to 3 grams of net carbs, and they're only 140 calories. They're gluten-free, grain-free, plant-based, and non-GMO, with no soy, trans fat, sugar alcohols, or high-intensity sweeteners. While they're great for anyone following a keto lifestyle, you absolutely do not have to be keto to love these. They're the perfect snack for anyone who's trying to eat better or cut back on sugar and carbs without sacrificing taste. I've been trying to eat healthier, and I found snacking to be so boring because it was tough to mix it up, and I love sweet foods. Baby carrots, almonds, dried fruit just wasn't cutting it. Monk Pack is now my go-to snack, as it's nutritious and delicious. It doesn't feel like I'm making a conscious, healthy decision because I really like eating them, so it actually feels like I'm making a tasty decision. Monk Pack Keto Granola Bars have a soft and chewy texture and come in delicious flavors like coconut cocoa chip, peanut butter, and blueberry almond vanilla. I love the blueberry almond vanilla flavor. It's soft, but also chewy. And to be honest, it reminded me of a cereal bar from when I was a kid, but it tastes even better. I bet if I was given the option then, I would have picked Monk Pack over that other brand. They're perfect for a quick breakfast, a snack between Zoom calls, or a guilt-free dessert. They taste incredible, and you can't beat the low-sugar nutrition they provide. And by shopping online, you can avoid another trip to the grocery store by getting Monk Pack delivered right to your door. Try it for yourself and you'll see. And we have a special deal for our listeners. Get 20% off your first purchase of any Monk Pack product by visiting monkpack.com and entering our code CRIME at checkout. And Monk Pack is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you don't like it for any reason, they'll exchange the product or refund your money, whichever you prefer. To get started, just go to munkpack.com and select any product. Then, Enter the code CRIME at checkout to save 20% off your purchase. Monk Pack, delicious, nutritious food you can count on. We thank them for sponsoring the podcast. Detective Michael DeJoseph is a seasoned investigator. He has a typical gumshoe look. Intelligent, tough, strong. And he authentically connects with his victims, including Hella.
A lovely person, a mom, a caring mom, a working mom, who really doted on her children.
Reporter Lisa Peterson's crime beat includes Newtown.
Hella Crafts is a 39-year-old airline flight attendant. She worked for Pan American Airlines, married to a pilot, Richard Crafts. She was your typical working mother in the 1980s who wanted to have it all. The family, the career, the lovely house.
And lovely it is. A rambling four-bedroom house on a big lot. With her high-flying job, Hella needs a live-in nanny. Her nanny's name is Dawn Marie Thomas.
She was employed by Mrs. Crafts, principally because Hella was traveled a lot because of her job.
On November 18th, 1986, Hella flies in from Frankfurt, Germany to the Big Apple.
She arrived at JFK Airport, and then her and another flight attendant drove back to Hella's house. The children were there, Richard was there.
Hella and Richard have been together for 17 years and married for 11. On the outside, everything looks perfect.
Hella and Richard had three children. They were here in Newtown schools. Occasionally, their parents would come to school for career day, and they would be the flight attendant and the pilot.
And they're active in the community. In fact, Richard is a part-time cop. Michael DeJoseph explains.
His job as an auxiliary policeman in Newtown would have been to check vacant houses, people were on vacation, do non-traditional law enforcement work. Direct traffic, if needed, assist at motor vehicle accident scenes.
But tonight, it's another tense evening in the Crafts house. Voices are raised, hurtful and angry words spoken. As a quiet counterpoint, snow softly falls, and falls, and falls.
Uncharacteristic snowstorm for that time in November. Very wet snow, power went out, widespread power outage in the Newtown area.
The next morning, Richard wakes the kids, telling them they're going on a surprise visit to his sister's. And he says this about their mother.
He said Hella Crafts had gotten out of bed, gotten dressed, taken her flight bags, and left the house.
Without so much as a goodbye. Richard Crafts drives his family to Westport. By that evening, there's still no word from Hella. Reconstructing known facts is Newtown Chief Criminologist Dr. Henry Lee.
So we know Hella was alive when her colleague dropped her in front of the house. We know she disappeared when the nanny woke up.
And that was the last time anyone had seen her.
No trail. Just disappeared out of thin air.
2 days crawl by. Hella's co-worker and friend, Trudy Horvath, calls Richard and asks after Hella. Richard tells Trudy Hella's tripping, gone to comfort her sick mother in Denmark.
And that Hella was going to see her for a few days. This is what he told the live-in babysitter, Dawn Marie Thomas, and he also told the children.
But that story doesn't sit right with Hella's friends. As he investigates, Michael DeJoseph keeps hearing the same thing.
Hella's friends thought that she was a wonderful woman, obviously, a good mom, a hard worker, good wife.
But the Crafts house is not a happy home. Lisa Peterson hears whispers of trouble in paradise.
Richard Crafts had an extramarital affair for over 20 years with a particular flight attendant. So it wasn't something that just showed up. that was sort of a part of who he was. He had always had other relationships with other women.
Hella has hired help, divorce lawyer Diane Anderson.
It was at the urging of Diane Anderson for Hella to hire a private investigator to help her document the fact that Richard was in fact having an affair.
The private dick is Keith Mayo, and he gets the goods. Pictures of Richard and his mistress doing the deed. But Richard resists Hella's petition.
But he did not allow the sheriff to serve him with divorce papers. He kept making excuses, made an appointment to be served the papers, and then didn't show up. You know, he wasn't making it really easy for her. So obviously there was, you know, some issue with not wanting to get divorced.
So now, nearly a week later, no Hella. Her friends file a missing persons report with the Newtown Police Department, and they recall Hella's dire warning.
She began to tell friends things like, you know, she thought Richard might be angry at her, and also that if she should disappear or if anything should happen to her, not to assume it was an accident. When she did disappear, that phrase, if anything should happen to me, don't assume it's an accident, came back to haunt them.
Hella's friend and fellow Scandinavian reaches out to Hella's mom.
Lena Johansson called Denmark to talk to Mrs. Nielsen, who was Hellycraft's mother. And what Lena had learned is that Mrs. Nielsen wasn't ill and also that she hadn't spoken to Hellycraft in several weeks.
The news sets off a ripple of fear through Hella's friends. Detective DeJoseph.
They were increasingly alarmed by her not responding to their calls and by her husband's making excuses about where she was. They didn't want to believe that she wasn't alive, but nonetheless, the disappearance was under very mysterious circumstances.
Hellycraft's friends didn't really like Richard, especially after Hellycraft's disappeared.
In light of the disturbing intel, detectives buttonhole Crafts.
Richard Crafts was approached by one of my colleagues in the early part of December and asked, "Where's your wife?" There are a lot of people who are suggesting that something could have happened to her, that she's missing. Is she missing? He just maintained the same story that he had told other investigators, that his wife just simply got up and left the house on November 19th.
Crafts, a cool customer. He even agrees to take a lie detector test.
It was an extensive examination administered by the Connecticut State Police, two polygraph examiners. It probably took between 2 to 3 hours, and they asked him questions relative to the disappearance of his wife. According to the polygraph examiners, he passed the polygraph test with no deception.
The examiner's opinion, Crafts does not know where Hella is.
People were wondering, how could such a lovely woman with children just disappear without contacting anyone? Why would a mother get up and just leave without saying goodbye to her children? Although he allegedly passed the polygraph examination, there were still questions that were no answers for.
But the polygraph reveals Crafts was lying about Hella heading to Denmark. He admits he lied, and why.
And his response was, "Well, I didn't want to air my dirty laundry about my marriage because it's really no one's business."
He didn't want people to know that she had left him.
Desperate for new leads, Newtown police ask for help from the Connecticut State Police. Chief criminologist Henry Lee reviews evidence, then puts together a task force.
I was contacted. The forensic laboratory got involved in assisting investigation. We decide to put the case together.
Meantime, Mike DeJoseph keeps his missing persons inquiry marching on.
You gather all the information you can about the person who's missing. You gather financial data, credit card data, places where the person might go, friends, associates, and you go from there.
And DeJoseph keeps other lines of inquiry open.
there was a lot of information coming into police headquarters relative to the disappearance of Hella Krabs. There were extensive interviews done with Hella's friends and family, either by myself or the other investigators who were working the case.
They also started interviewing neighbors, looking into financial records to see if Hella's credit card had been used anywhere. And there was no activity for Hella Krabs. She had been missing since November 19th. She had missed the Thanksgiving dinner with the family.
And then nanny Dawn Thomas recalls something unusual.
Ms. Thomas told investigators that she had seen some stains on a carpet.
And when she asked Richard Krabs what that stain was, he said it was from the kerosene heater. During Storm Carl, the electricity went out. He had taken two kerosene heaters out of the garage and brought them into the house, one in the master bedroom. He said the heater had spilled the kerosene.
And the nanny adds,
in that Mr. Krabs had subsequently removed a carpet from the Krabs bedroom. He told investigators that he had taken the carpet out of his home, but had put it in a landfill in Newtown.
Keith Mayo, Hella's private eye, takes a trip to the dump.
And found a carpet in the landfill. The carpet was turned over to the investigative team who took the carpet to the lab, the forensic science laboratory, submitted for analysis. It was nothing on the carpet to suggest that there was any trace evidence, blood, or any other substance that could link the carpet to Mrs. Krabs or to Mr. Krabs.
A lot of effort to hit a dead end. Cops turned to Krabs's financial activity.
We were working with credit card companies trying to determine if he had made any purchases, odd purchases, in the weeks following his wife's disappearance.
The first thing that Newtown police found was that he had charged some bedding. He had bought some pillows and a new comforter, which was kind of unusual. He did it the day after the storm, so that was kind of odd.
But there's something else on the credit card statement that catches Michael DeJoseph's eye.
Mr. Krabs had rented a wood chipper during the storm, the November 18, 1920 storm.
What's a wood chipper? Well, it's a machine that grinds huge, hard tree branches into itsy-bitsy pieces.
And that immediately raised our suspicions even more that something terrible had happened.
So the Newtown Police Department was really setting the groundwork for an investigation into a homicide.
As the bedding factored in, as the wood chipper factored in, building the probable cause for the search warrant was moving ahead.
So a picture of deadly malfeasance emerges. And a judge signs a search warrant to dive deep into the Krabs home. On Christmas Day, they pull the trigger. Lisa Peterson describes the scene.
Carpets had been torn up. Furniture was all askew in different bedrooms. They found some things that had been burned in the fireplace. It wasn't what you'd expect to find in a family home.
The heavy hitters, a forensics team led by Dr. Henry Lee, combed the scene.
And we found the king-size mattress was put on the side. We found some blood spatter on the mattress.
The types of forensic tests that Dr. Lee and his team would have done in the house might have included a presumptive test for blood, especially the blood spattering that they found on the mattress. They would also look for blood in places like down the drains, in a tub or a sink. They would use luminol on the walls to see if there was blood splatter there as well.
Blood spatter. Experts analyze the volume and position of blood droplets to determine movements used to create patterns.
In the bedroom, the mattress alone give us a clue something have to have a medium force, impact force, to get those spatter, to produce those spatter.
Testing reveals the blood is that of a female, and the blood type matches Hella. But that's not enough hard evidence to collar Krabs. Lisa Peterson.
The police didn't have a lot to go on. They had no murder weapon. They had no crime scene. They had no witnesses.
Criminologist Henry Lee.
When Hallicraft first disappeared, we think of all four possibilities. First, run away. Second, kidnapped. Third, some accident happened. Fourth, she be murdered. If she was murdered, where's the body? When we search their house, we look at the refrigerator, we even look at the septic tank, every place. We did not find her body.
So now the investigation stalls. Then, more than a month after Hella's disappearance, a snowplow driver named Joseph Heim comes forward with a case-breaking story about something he saw the night of the big storm.
It was either very late at night or early in the morning. Just no one was out. Mr. Heim saw a man in the middle of a storm. It was very strange.
The man Heim sees is Richard Crafts. The snowplow operator tells police he passed by once and then back again several hours later.
Heim even said Mr. Crafts, as Mr. Heim's plow approached, Mr. Crafts just motioned for Mr. Heim to go around him. Mr. Heim's story was very important because it put Mr. Crafts on the steel bridge.
The steel bridge crosses the Housatonic River. Heim's statement rings a bell for Dr. Henry Lee, that forensic specialist with the state police.
We want to know where's the body. Through the witness statement, we think the most likely place is the Lake Zor.
Lake Zor exists as part of the Housatonic, a short drive from the Crafts' home. Forensic specialists set up shop beneath that steel bridge where snowplow operator Joe Heim saw Crafts and his wood chipper. Lisa Peterson and the press tailed a major crime squad.
I had gone down to Lake Zor early on in the investigation. It was interesting to watch because they were working furiously. They had erected a tent village where people from the major crime squad were working, and so they brought in the major crime squad van, and they started to sift through all these piles of wood chips that they had found along the edge of Lake Zor.
Took us days and days, and in this cold weather, we found 56 little bone chips, 2,660 hairs. We found the tooth.
What Henry Lee's team finds is a soggy pile of small and shredded bits of a human being. But the name of the game is linkage, creating that vital chain of evidence.
We found a dental crown. We found half of the toenail and part of the finger. We was able to link the hair together. We linked the tooth together. We linked the bone together. Now we can positively say Hallicraft was murdered.
There's less than 3 ounces of Hella left, and the cold, careful work on the Lake Zor shore yields another critical piece of linkage for DeJoseph.
There was shredded mail found in the vicinity where Mr. Heim had seen Mr. Crafts, and the mail happened to be correspondence from Mrs. Crafts' mother.
Then, police divers working the current below the bridge hit the jackpot. They find a chainsaw.
When the divers brought the saw to the surface, it was later examined by forensic people. I think there was human tissue on the chainsaw.
The chainsaw belongs to Crafts. He bought it at a local hardware store. Henry Lee follows up.
We talked to the owner. He said, I have a receipt in the shoebox. Visa, $499 for that chainsaw. Richard Crafts on it. The serial number, E592-1616, always remember. That clue linked this chainsaw to Richard Crafts. It's a major breakthrough.
The gathering of forensic evidence in the Hallicraft murder is precedent-setting. It's clear Crafts has chopped up and shredded his special someone.
You have to remember that there had never been an arrest, let alone a conviction, in the state of Connecticut or even in the United States without a body.
Newtown detective Michael DeJoseph prepares to collar Crafts, and though he stages a standoff for a few hours, Crafts soon surrenders. It's a sensational story that Lisa Peterson is following. Do you have a cabinet full of acne treatments and skincare products, but don't even remember what half of them do? It's always been a struggle to navigate skincare products, and for me, it's been especially difficult finding acne treatment products that work from a very young age. I'm not a dermatologist. Most of us aren't. So I was wasting so much money based on friends' opinions and advertising, but not actually knowing what my skin really needs. Turns out, most skincare products don't do much. The best way to treat acne is with fewer products that are clinically proven and customized to your skin. That's why I immediately got excited about the partnership with Apostrophe. Apostrophe is a prescription skincare company that offers science-backed oral and topical medications that are clinically proven to help clear acne. Apostrophe connects you with a board-certified dermatologist who will create a personalized treatment plan that is perfectly tailored to your unique skin. Simply fill out Apostrophe's online quiz about your skin goals and medical history. Then snap a few selfies and your dermatologist will create your customized treatment plan. Apostrophe treats acne, and they can also help you hit your other skincare goals, like reducing redness, wrinkles, and even dark spots. I couldn't believe the ease of getting an appointment and how quickly I saw the dermatologist. It was such a great session, and I learned a lot about my skin and its needs. Before, I had no idea what I really needed, but now I feel empowered. I have a tailored plan specifically for me, which gave me so much confidence coming out of the appointment. We have a special deal for our audience. Save $15 off your first visit with a board-certified dermatologist at apostrophe.com/crime when you use our code CRIME. This code is only available to our listeners. To get started, just go to apostrophe.com/crime and click Begin Visit. Then use our code CRIME at sign up and you'll get $15 off your dermatology visit. That's apostrophe.com/crime. And use that code CRIME to get your dermatology visit and save $15. And we thank Apostrophe for sponsoring the podcast.
Back in the 1980s, it wasn't the 24/7 news machine that we have today. There was no Fox News Channel or CNN. And this case really sparked that kind of coverage here in Connecticut. So when it finally broke and Richard was arrested, the media descended on Newtown, Connecticut from all over the world, from Denmark, from New York City, from all over Connecticut. And it was just this huge media circus.
Detective Michael DeJoseph and criminologist Henry Lee have put together a very complex case.
The first trial took 4.5 months. There were hundreds of witnesses, thousands of pieces of evidence and documents that were put into evidence. And it was very painstakingly presented.
This is the most lengthy investigation we ever conducted at that time. A lot of physical evidence, DNA typing, blood grouping, hair comparison, tool mark comparison, fiber comparison, handwriting analysis.
And after 4.5 months, a hung jury.
It went into 17 days of deliberations, which was also the longest in state history. One juror refused to deliberate anymore because he was voting for an acquittal. And as far as he was concerned, nothing was going to change his mind.
A second trial is ordered and moved to Norwalk, Connecticut. It's now 1989, and state prosecutor Walter Flanagan tries his case again. Michael DeJoseph and Henry Lee recall the prosecution's crime timeline.
Helen returned from her trip. Either that night or early the next morning, Helen and Richard argued. Richard assaulted her in the house, probably killed her in the house.
Helen was hit with something, a blunt object. Richard is pretty strong.
Killed her in the house with a blunt object. Crafts then carries Hella to the backyard and drops her in his freezer. The corpse chills.
Because a fresh body, when you cut, pretty difficult with a chisel. Once it froze, you can cut in sections.
But then that massive snowstorm knocks out the power. Kratz improvises. He hauls his kids to his sister's, saying he'll be back at 2.
He did not pick them up until that night.
He rents a truck and a wood chipper. Detective DeJoseph conjectures.
In his mind, he thought that there's no oddity in me having a wood chipper because I've had it before. I've rented it before. There's a paper trail. People know that I do lot clearing, so it would not be uncommon for me to have a wood chipper.
Crafts drives his rented truck onto a bridge across the Housatonic. Starts up his chainsaw. Starts up his wood chipper. Then he chops his wife's body into chunks and drops them to the chipper. A cascade of blood and bone and tissue falling onto the shoreline below. And the snowstorm of the century soon conceals his deed. If Joe Hine hadn't spotted Crafts on that bridge, his plan may have worked. As the details play out in court, Richard sits stone-faced.
Richard's demeanor in court I would characterize as being the same as it always been. Very low-key, very nonchalant.
This time, it takes the jury just 3 days to return their verdict. Crafts is guilty of first-degree murder.
Crafts was sentenced to 50 years in prison. And at the time in the state of Connecticut, there was no allowance for paroles.
It's taken 3 long years to bring the vicious killer to justice. It's the best outcome for Detective Michael DeJoseph.
Although it took 2 trials to convict him, I think justice was still served.
Crafts today lives in the state of Connecticut. He's up at the Summers Correctional Institute.
How did the Crafts murder case affect young reporter Lisa Peterson?
The Richard Crafts murder trial was a case of a lifetime for a journalist. It was high profile, it was groundbreaking, it was historic. And as a young journalist for me, it was a wonderful opportunity to really do some great work, journalistically speaking. I tried really hard to be very objective and to present both sides, which, you know, is difficult in an intricate case like this.
And how does Detective Michael DeJoseph remember the most sensational crime of his career?
I think I remember what everyone else remembers, is that how could anybody murder your wife and put her through a wood chipper? It's just unbelievable. And what always pops into my mind about this case is a snowstorm in a beautiful, small New England community and all spoiled by a murder.
Thanks for listening. See you next time for more Murder Time.
Simon Decker wrote and produced The Chainsaw Killer, working with files from the television series Crime Stories, Blood, Lies, and Alibis, and Catching Killers. Our executive producer is Ron Getz. Our supervising producer is Robert Laughlin, and our technical producer is Joe Watts. Murder Time is a production of Partners in Motion.